And we are just live, just a couple minutes late. It is definitely not the fault of my guest. I've had some technical BS going on here today, guys, but we're going to have a good one today. I announced this yesterday, right at the end of yesterday's show, but we're going to have somebody back on the air with us who has not been here for quite a while, Peter Quinones, who I go way back with. Peter and I were part of a kind of a podcast supergroup we put together called Unloosed Goose way back around the beginning of the COVID era. And he's been on the show a couple times. I've been on with him a couple times, and it's good to have him back on. We're going to be talking about community organizing today. That was the topic he threw at it. And I look at it more of like, what the hell can we do about what's going on in the world? And I think for both of us, some of the things that we've come through that, like, there's all these great ideas and great philosophies and things that would be wonderful if they were, but they're not, and they're not going to be. And there's a pragmatic approach to dealing with the world the way it is today. We're going to be talking about that in a variety of ways. And as I said in the promo for this, I'm pretty sure we will entertain, inform, and offend every single person who listens today at some point. So you have thus been warned. Anyway, with that, before we get into it, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day today. Sponsor of the day number one today is JM Bullion. You know, I have been recommending the exact same thing with precious metals since I started my show all the way back over 3,700 episodes ago in 2008, which is 5% of your net worth in precious metals, up to 10, but my recommendation specifically is 5. And you'd think, well, then it doesn't matter where I get my precious metals. Should I buy from JM Bullion just because they sponsor Jack's show? It's not a bad reason. It really isn't. It's all the same. That's the point. But you can pay less. You can get free shipping. And you can get a discount if you're an MSB member. That's why you should buy from JM Bullion versus all the people you hear trying to advertise on TV and stuff like that. And one more thing. I've actually heard from two of the biggest companies in the industry trying to get this spot. I haven't given it to them over the years. And there's a reason. Let me talk to your president, your CEO, somebody like that. Oh, no, Mr. So-and-so's too. Well, then I'm not talking to you because I know the president personally at JM Bullion, and that means if there's a problem, I can get it fixed. Because when the person that owns or is the president of a company tells you to do something, you know what you do? You do it. That's how that works. Next up today, the Wealth Studying Podcast with John Pugliano. John is a member of the Expert Council. He's been working with us since 2010. That's quite a long time in the world of podcasting. He's also one of us. He's not just an investment manager. He is also a prepper. He's a gardener. He's got a ham radio operator. He's all of the above. In fact, I first met him at a prepper convention in Salt Lake City back in 2010. And that's, again, when he started working with us. He does this podcast called the Wealth Studying Podcast, where you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. You should tune in. It's only about once a week, generally runs between 10 and 20 minutes, and it's what he's doing with his money and his clients' money right now in the market. That might be something you want to know about. So with that, I want to say welcome to the show, guys, and let's bring our special guest, Peter Quinones, on. Peter, welcome back to the show, man.
How are you doing, Jack? I like that part about being able to offend everyone, because I assume we're going to get to that today.
I don't think it's impossible that we won't offend everyone. I think I offend everybody every day, and I've been doing it for almost 18 years now. So to not do it when you're here, that just seems impossible. I really don't know how that would happen, but
I'm a really bad influence too. So
yeah. Peter might offend some of you that I typically don't offend. And you know what? You'll get over it. You won't die. You know, because remember that? I mean, that was when we were kids, right? All this shit happened, but did you die?
Yep.
You didn't die? Okay, you're fine then. You're going to be all right. For people that don't know you, though, and maybe weren't around my community back when we were working together more regularly, can you kind of give your background? Like, how did you get into this whole world? You're a podcaster. You're an author. You're very involved in the political space, and I would say the liberty space. How did that all come to be? Because usually people don't, you know, kind of pop out of mom and that's what they want to be when they grow up.
I have the very typical came into this Ron Paul 2008, 2007, 2008. But very quickly after seeing that, you know, basically people didn't really want Liberty. They weren't willing to vote for him, not really understanding what the system was at that point. I dropped out, and then I started paying attention again when Trump was running. And it all just seemed very circusy to me. And I thought that was pretty exciting. You know, it was like anything to delegitimize the system that we're under. And then, you know, so I started the podcast in 2017, mostly libertarian, even anarcho-capitalist leaning, stayed in that direction, always had a sympathy towards agorism as a practice, but not as a political. A lot of people see agorism as a political kind of venue. So when 2020 hit, it just seemed like, okay, this tells me nobody cares about liberty. No one's saying, very few people are saying no to what's going on. And, you know, I decided, well, people are just waiting around to being told what to do. So I went through the year, you know, we podcasted about agorism and, you know, doing things outside of the system, which is still good. I mean, finally got to move out to the country where my wife grows a lot of food. I mean, a lot of the food we're eating now is right out of our backyard and everything. But as libertarianism is explained to me, is that, you know, everybody's a libertarian. They just don't know it. Well, to me, they had their chance in 2020 and they told me, no, they're not all libertarians. They're basically order followers. So I just decided, you know, if that's the way people are, then, well,
just real quick, before you keep going, for people that may not have caught on to that, he wasn't talking about the 2020 election. Just saying, right? Something else happened in that year. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, it was definitely that spicy cold that popped up. Then you pile on it, you know, the summer of George, and then the election, and it's like you really start to understand that not only do people not want liberty, but this government's been hijacked. And you're not getting your way. So what do? And that's when, you know, localism to me up until that point was, you know, you got together with some people, you traded food, you did this, you did that and everything. Now localism came to me to be politics. Get involved in local politics if you can, state politics. So I started studying realpolitik, looking at, you know, guys like James Burnham, who wrote the book The Machiavellians, who talk about, you know, how power actually works. And then, you know, you come all the way forward and, you know, I say there were a bunch of like watershed moments over the past 20 years. One was the 2008 financial crisis. Second was Trump getting elected. The third was COVID. The fourth was October 7th, 2023. And to me, we're living right now in the fifth one. And that is as more becomes clear through the Epstein files. So what I see is we live live under a government that has been completely hijacked by a very small group of incredibly vile, evil people. And what do we do in the meantime? How do we fight back against this? And, you know, what do we do in the meantime just to survive? So that's pretty much, that's takes me from when I started really looking into politics up until this morning.
And the phrase that comes to my mind as I'm listening to that, the illusion of power, right? And what I mean by that is one of the reasons people continue to fight pointlessly, like a fly in a window, right? If that fly just understood, it could just go backwards and have the whole house, find an open door, go be a fly, it would live. But instead it sees what it's looking for and it just pounds that window and it has no hope. of ever getting through that window. And that's the average voter today, right? Because they have this illusion of power, they keep trying that angle and they keep fighting with each other and they get nowhere. And then the other side of that illusion of power is that you actually think, you know, at a global level, at an international level, even at a national level, that the people that you send to Washington are in power. That's the other illusion of power. You have power because you elect them. You have no power to elect them. Whoever they install gets installed. And they don't have much power either. If you look at, like, to me, the best thing to come from Doge was nothing, because it showed people that nothing could really be done. For all the talk, closing USAID, et cetera, all the money still going to 99% of the same places. And people are like, wow. And what did Musk say? Something like it's easier to make a colony on Mars than to change the government. And I think only when you accept futility in one angle can you then say, okay, since I don't want to be a dead fly in a windowsill, what's my other angle? Where can I find a point of power, a point of leverage?
Well, you have to look at the people who are in power and see what they're doing. And mm-hmm. What libertarianism promotes is it promotes a radical individualism. And after a while, I started to think, was this promoted on purpose? Yeah. To make people not collectivize? Because when I look at the world, the people that have power, the people that are in charge, the people that are doing all of this evil, they've collectivized. And if you're not willing to, if all you're worried about is, you know, oh, I'm going to be the most pure libertarian, and this is all about me, and this is, you know, I have to worry about myself. Well, you know, I was thinking during the summer of George that it's like, okay, you got that guy who's like, oh yeah, you know, when the hordes come, I'll just be up on my roof with a 308, you know, and I'll be taking off a pick. It's like, nah, man. Now, if you're by yourself and you're stacking ammo and you have no, you can't call somebody within like, and get like, 5 or 6 guys, 10 guys to come within 20 minutes, that you just bought ammo for people that collectivized. You just bought guns for people that collectivized. And that goes the same with politics. If you are going to pose any kind of or construct any kind of resistance to this globalist faction, then you're going to have to do it locally. And if you have a small enough state, or if you have a state that your guys can actually get control of the levers of power, then you can make a stand against this. Mm. Because, you know, not only do these people have power, money, wealth, all of that, but they also have weapons. They also have army. You know, they have an army that they can mobilize. And when you look at just the stuff that came out of that's coming out of, like, look, I the greatest thing about this whole Epstein thing is seeing pizza mentioned in it, because I knew right off the bat Pizzagate was real. I mean, I did a podcast with Daryl Cooper where we sort of, he just laid out the facts, and it was like, okay, well, you know, you have all these people going into this pizza shop, you have these symbols, you have these emails with people talking about pizza. And then, like, the guy who owns a pizza shop, who's just basically, and is married to, like, and is gay married to the head of Media Matters, which debunks all of this stuff. Is considered one of the 50 a pizza shop owner is considered one of the 50th most powerful people in DC. There's something wrong here. So, you know, I mean, just my psychotic, you know, talking about, yeah, Pizzagate was real all this time. And now you get to see that it wasn't only these guys talking about, they're all throughout the emails, and they're talking about pizza. They're talking about jerky. They're talking about what the hell's going on? Who are these people? And why are we allowing them to have power over us? It just doesn't. If until people come to that realization that you're being ruled by people that, you know, basically are the epitome of evil and will do anything to keep that power and to wield that power. And you know, will compromise anyone from a politician to a child. I mean, you start to realize I need friends, and we really need to start preparing.
And I think the local is the place to start. I think maybe from a leverage point, though, with government, if you can work it out where you're at, if you can gain power somewhere in it, I don't believe it's federally. It'd be great if it is, but it's not happening. The problem with, like, becoming part of a town council or a mayor, like, you have some influence, but it's more just to prevent new shit from happening. It's hard to really mount a defense from there. And the state, and like you said, unless it's a really small state or something, it can be almost insurmountable. So, I mean, Texas has 29 million people. It's like a country. But the county seems like the point where you could have the most leverage up and down to prevent shit from coming down and to resist stuff from the state and federal level as much as possible.
Yeah, a lot of people who've seen this for decades, you know, John Birch Society immediately comes to mind, have always talked about how the county sheriff has an insane amount of power. I mean, if you remember when they were talking about gun bans back under Obama, there were sheriffs in California who were like, yeah, we're not going to help you enforce these laws. I think there was a sheriff in Virginia who was like, I'll deputize the whole town so that they can legally under law own whatever guns they want.
Yeah.
And I remember that one. That's the power of local. Now, if they want to target you, they can crush you. I mean, the federal government can crush a local area, sure. But it's like, if that's your reasoning and you're like, okay, well, then we're not going to try and do anything, then, I mean, really, you're just sitting there waiting for whatever is coming down the pike. I don't understand the people who are like, well, if we do this, that puts a target on our back. And I'm like, well, you already have a target on your back, especially if you're a rural area. I mean, that's the areas that they really hate. I've been talking about local politics now for about 6 years. And really, when I study what's happening in local politics throughout the country, it seems like the Democrats have been listening to me more than, you know, people on the right have. Because the Democrats have started to understand how important local politics is. I mean, I live in the middle of agricultural Alabama in a town of 2,500, and they've tried to put the books in the library here. I mean, this is a town with, you know, 20 Baptist churches. This is not there's nothing cosmopolitan about the town I live in. And, you know, they had somebody at City Hall who was like, oh, you can't have, you know, all the churches get together and do this mass prayer thing in the city park. And mm-hmm. they hired someone at the city hall who said, no, we have the separation of church and state. You can't have a permit to do that. And they basically ran these people out of town because, well, they have the power to do that when you're in a small town. And it was like one person it was only really one person who, you know, stood up and said, look, we're not going to stand for this. So you're in the wrong place, carpetbagger. Go away. Yankee, go home. This is not for you here. So you have a lot of power when it comes to local politics, because I don't know how anybody can look at Washington, D.C., see, you know, as Thomas Massey, you know, revealed on Tucker Carlson, how many people, how it's like all but maybe four or five congressmen are taking money from, you know, one organization that represents a tiny little country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you look and you see that, you know, the president started this thing called the President Trump's Religious Liberty Commission, where people are supposed to get together and they're supposed to talk about the differences. And then Carrie Prejean Buller stands, you know, sits there and says, look, I'm a Catholic. It is not in my faith to be a Zionist. I do not believe that the modern state of Israel has anything to do with biblical prophecy, which I agree to as a Catholic. Even when I was I flirted with Protestantism, and the Protestant denomination I was with didn't look at Israel as like some fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And they basically said, look, if you're anti-Zionist, you're anti-Semitic. And she said, so what you're saying is that every Catholic is anti-Semitic. They kicked her off the council today. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick of Texas kicked her off the council today. You could say,
they have our next. It's not Patrick that's going to go after the Senate. That's Paxton. I think he's going to be running for something else soon.
He looks too much like Lindsey Graham to me.
Yeah,
he has too much of a style of Lindsey Graham, and I assume he has the same predilections as Lindsey Graham if he looks like that. These people are all on the take. They are all bought and sold. And there is nothing you can do with them. You know, Texas, I look at Texas. I've been to Texas 6 or 7 times in the last like 4 or 5 years. I have friends in Texas, visit them all the time. I haven't gotten your way yet, Jack, or else I would have called. Yeah. But and I'm like, it feels like a different country when you're in Texas. It feels like the people have a different attitude. Mm-hmm. But then I look at the state government and I talk to my buddies in Texas who follow, Texas politics really quick. And even the Republicans are worse than the Democrats, I think. It's just terrible. And it's like, I don't know. You can only make a stand countywide at this point, sometimes even city. And if you're not. Like I said, if you're not collectivizing, if that's not where your goals are pointed right now, if you think that you're going to vote for J.D. Vance in 2028 and something is going to change, I'm sorry. You've lost the plot. Donald Trump is not here to save us. Thank you for closing the southern border, Donald Trump. Can you close the northern border, please?
Yeah.
Because that's where all the fentanyl is coming from. And there's a shit ton of Indians up there that I don't want coming over the border, and Chinese people who work for CCP. Oh, and can we also mention the 600,000 Chinese college students we have in this country right now? Oh, yeah. China's the enemy. But then you have 600,000 military aged men and women in this country that you're allowing to stay. What the fuck is going on here? How do you think that national politics, even Donald Trump with all of his bluster and everything, I mean, who's basically bought and sold by Israel, if you don't believe that, you haven't been paying attention for the last year or to his first, this second one would be just his interest with Israel would be just like the first one. Throw him a bone every once in a while. Hey, the embassy's in Jerusalem now. I didn't think he was going to be bought and sold and go to start dropping bombs for them, threatening other countries. Venezuela just sent their first shipment of oil to Israel in years. Oh, is that why we bombed Venezuela? No one's coming to save us at the national level. No one. You elect maybe a Franco, a Francisco Franco, somebody who's going to just absolutely destroy, everybody up there, go to war with everybody up there. But that's what I thought Donald Trump was going to do. I thought he was draining the swamp. Well, it turns out the swamp is Israel. So how are we not draining that? I get told things. I mean, we have 6 ships by Iran right now.
Yeah.
We have planes flying supplies, what I assume are missile batteries right now, over to that section.
Yeah.
Who's this for?
They're talking about sending the second carrier group on top of what's already there. The second carrier group by itself could level every city in Iran.
But why
are we doing this? Because people were protesting in the streets? Like, we didn't do anything.
Who cares?
We were actually protesting in the streets, right? Like, if you were actually trying to, like, aid some sort of, like, populist takeover, that would be the time you would do this. Like, so that's all. They went out and slaughtered thousands of their own people, and we're outraged, but we didn't do anything. But now we're going to do something unless they make a deal. And what deal are they? Usually when they're going to make a deal, whatever that is, they kind of lay out like your 5 points. I haven't even heard what they want. Like, what do we want in return for not bombing another country?
Why is it that every country that is our enemy is also Israel's enemy?
Yes, that's an interesting thing. And I do want to come back to the Epstein thing, because when I think the shamelessness of misdirection has reached a pinnacle and it can't possibly get any dumber, and they can't possibly expect that their public IQ has dropped further that they can sell something, right when all of the files drop, what do they say? Oh, actually, he's working for Russia. What in the absolute dumbfuckery? Epstein is working for Russia. Really?
Even though the files clearly show that he was trying to find a line to Putin, he had no communication line to Putin. And that's what the files say over and over again. This Russia thing. Look, I'm sorry, Jack. I'm going to piss some people off right now. Look, I've studied Russian history. Okay. Jews hate Russia. Not every Jew, of course. But there is a Jewish animosity towards Russia because they say, oh, we were there and we got treated so poorly and everything like that. And then you can look. And then when the Bolshevik Revolution happens, what happens? Well, Trotsky comes from New York, brings 20 people with him. They all happen to be of a certain religion. And they take over the government there. What's the first thing that Lenin does? They put their goy in charge, Lenin. What's the first thing he does? He passes anti-Semitism laws. He says anybody who's anti-Semitic is anti-revolution. What the hell does that mean? Then you look at all of the councils. They're all over. Jews are 3% of the population in Russia. And like every council has like 20%, 30%. The Cheka had 40%, 50% at one point. And then Stalin, slowly Jewish power starts going out with Stalin and everything. And then finally, you see like the neocons, they're anti-Russia. It's funny. What are most of the neocons also? They're also mostly Jewish. They hate Russia. But what happens when Russia falls? You see all these people rush to Russia in 1991 and they start looting the country. Mm-hmm. Russia's standard of living falls incredibly. The average age of an adult male drops 10 years in the span of like 5 years. Putin comes in and puts all these people to heel. He had to make a lot of concessions with people. He still talks to the Chabad network. A lot of people say the Chabad network's in charge. I don't believe that. But basically, Putin, there were 7 oligarchs, just like there's 7 oligarchs in Ukraine. They just happen to be all Jewish. There were oligarchs in Russia. They just happen to be all Jewish. And he put them to heel. Now Russia becomes the enemy again. And I mean, look who was pushing for Ukraine. Jeffrey Epstein in the files is telling Rothschild they have to push for Ukraine. Mm-hmm. What's her name? Victoria Nuland. Oh. Where's her family from? Ukraine.
Karen. Yeah.
Where's her family from?
Yeah.
Ukraine, Russia. Her husband, Robert Kagan. Where's his family from? Ukraine, Russia. All of Biden's, like 80% of Biden's cabinet, including his secretary of state, his attorney general, all these people, they all came from Ukraine. They're all Ukrainian Jews with a historic animosity toward this section of the world. And so they basically create this, you know, orchestrated so that Putin has to do something. Let me tell you something. If I was Putin, I would have invaded Ukraine in 2014. The guy has way more patience than I do. You're going to start killing my people. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to mess you up. And he should have went in there harder. I think he just thought it was going to be a lot easier.
I think he's shown a tremendous amount of restraint trying not to involve a larger European theater in the conflict. I really believe if he wanted to, he could take the entire country, but that would require striking specific assets in specific locations that would be more likely to bring in, you know, other European forces. And so I think he's tried to avoid that. This idea that I don't care how much weaponry you give the Ukrainians that they can defeat the Russian military is preposterous. It's absolutely nonsensical. It just doesn't work out. Like the body count issue alone, it doesn't work out. But it sure is a great way to grift a bunch of money. And what you said about killing Russians, I think people still struggle with this. I've been viciously attacked because I've been on the same point with this since this whole thing started. When they formed the Soviet Union and they brought in these republics, they called them satellite republics like Ukraine, Lithuania, Georgia, Estonia, they actually made them larger and drugged their borders back so that when they formed Ukraine, the eastern piece of Ukraine was Russia. The Donbas was Russia. And they did that from a political pragmatism of, we have loyalists on the ground inside this new republic that's kind of like a state in the United States. And so all that shit that went on for years in eastern Ukraine was basically an ethnic war between ethnic Russians and ethnic Ukrainians. And I say this as somebody that half my family's from Ukraine. Right. So like, it's not like, you know, I have some sort of animosity against Ukraine itself. I'm just calling balls and strikes down the middle here with what happened. And that's what was going on. And our media was never fond of Ukraine until that war started. Like if you go prior to.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's all the articles in Ukraine and they're violating their treaty and blah. Like it's just
human trafficking, everything.
And then overnight, it's all Putin's fault. I'm sorry.
Let us not ignore the fact that Russia is Orthodox Christian and Ukraine is Orthodox Christian. So you get Christians to kill Christians. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. After the way I see the animosity I see towards, you know, someone like Kari Prigozhin-Bowler over the last 48 hours, this just seems to be a pattern. And you know, the Orthodox Church, you know, when you look at the history of Russia, you know, all they want to talk pogroms. There were these insane pogroms against Jews. They would just go into Jewish towns and kill everybody. Well, I mean, that's a really nice story and everything. And sure, sometimes things happened, but really what happened was when you start seeing this is you see this with the rise of Marxism. Hmm. And Jews in Russia embraced that revolutionary spirit. People don't even know about the 1905 revolution. They tried to, Jacob Schiff, Jewish banker in New York, financed an uprising in Odessa, trying to take over the government, trying to have a revolt against the country in 1905, while Russia is at war with Japan on the other side of the friggin' continent, and Jacob Schiff is financing the Japanese against the Russians in that war.
Yeah.
And yeah. What happened is they rise, these revolutionaries rise up, led by a lot of Jews, fighting, and then when they rise up, the Russians rise up and say, no, this isn't going to happen, and they crush them, and as soon as they start crushing them, all the newspapers back west start going, oh, pogrom, they're killing these people because they're Jewish, not because they're Marxist revolutionaries, but because they're Jewish. Hmm. It's the same kind of thing you see. You saw this in the last 48 hours. Kari Prigozhin-Bowler is saying, look, nowhere in the Catholic Church is there anything saying that this is modern Israel is a fulfillment of prophecy. Well, you're an anti-Semite. You need to be destroyed. You have people calling for her to be killed on Twitter. Okay.
I've been paying attention to other things, honestly. So I'm not familiar with that story, but it also does not surprise me things like that used to surprise me. And I think I'm at a point now where if I'm surprised, something really fucking crazy happened. Like we found life on the moon or some shit. It's what it, no, really, like, oh, they did this. Of course they did. You know?
Well, and let me just interject real quick. The things I just said about Russia and the 1905 revolution, don't believe me. Believe Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah.
Alexander Solzhenitsyn is the one who went and put all of this together. He could read Russian. He went into old Russian newspapers. He went into old Russian writings about what was happening at the time. He read Jewish historians at the time, what they were writing. This isn't made up. Our history is made up here. I mean, who controlled McGraw-Hill Publishing, which was like half of our textbooks in the United States?
Maxwell's dad?
Ghislaine Maxwell's dad, Robert Maxwell, was basically an agent for Israel.
Yeah.
Okay, so
when you were in school, guys, you're sitting here listening to Peter right now. If you, when you think back, any of you guys that are like older millennials and back anyway, especially, and you went to school, and they told you like it was important to take care of your textbook, and you brought your grocery bag, and you made a cover for it, you learned all your stuff out of that book, it was published by Ghislaine Maxwell's dad. Like, okay, that's why I had a science book in eighth grade. I shit you not, Peter. Eighth grade, so this is the 80s, and I have this weird memory where I can retain shit, and I remember turning to the front of the book when I saw what was in the back of the book to see when it was published. It was published in 78, okay? And there was this infographic on the back about when we would be out of the fossil fuels. And we had, like, 135 years of coal, it said at the point. But it said we had 35 years of oil left. Now, the propaganda that is so obvious now. But you know what? When you're an eighth grade kid, and this is in your school book, my dad ran a gas station, so I was freaked out. Like, I took it, showed him, and his response was, shit. Right? So I felt better about it. But when I first saw that in a school book, you take shit seriously when you're a kid in school and you're trying to do what you're told and get good grades and all that. And so here's this, like, not a generation, multiple generations now, raised on textbooks that were put together by and curated by the father of a woman is probably part of the biggest sex trafficking scheme on the planet. And I believe, and no one will ever convince me it's not, this whole thing is connected directly to frickin' not just Israel, but Mossad. Oh, no. I 100% believe. Can I prove it? No. And I'll be the first one, but I can't prove it. But I haven't seen anything compelling that tells me to not believe that. It has all the earmarks of a Mossad op to it.
So Ghislaine Maxwell has actually said that she believes that Mossad killed her dad. He fell off a boat. Do you know where he's buried?
No idea.
He's buried on the Mount of Olives across from Jerusalem, outside of Jerusalem, where state dignitaries get buried.
Interesting.
I mean, come on, stop. Can we stop with this? I mean, I'm your age, Jack, so I remember the 80s.
Yeah.
Remember when people would, like, get targeted because they used the term ZOG, Zionist Occupied Government? Only white supremacists use that?
Yeah.
How do you argue against that? Unless you believe the Qatar theory, you know, did you know that six of the eight Ivy League schools in this country, their presidents are from Qatar?
I did not know that. No.
Oh, they're not actually. They're Jewish.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. 2% of the 2% of the population, 2% of the population, six of the Ivy League presidents are actually Jewish. That's because they have really high IQs, although the average IQ in Israel is 93.
Huh.
Okay. So, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm not. Look, it is obvious that this country is run by Israel. Anybody who, like, Adam Curry. You remember the old guy? You remember the VJ?
Oh, yeah.
You've had him on the show? Oh, yeah. He will not say that we're an Israeli occupied government, that we're a Zionist occupied government. No, he actually went and found some obscure historian who came in and explained how, actually we control Israel. Everything Israel does is we're controlling it. I'm like, look, man, I know that you, I'm glad that you came to Christ. I'm sorry that you went to some mega church where this is what they teach, that, you know, that Israel is the fulfillment of some prophecy and everything, but you're just wrong. And I wouldn't care, except he has he has an audience, you know, that kind of is
about 11 million.
closing in as big as yours, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like,
well, he's way bigger than me, dude. He's way bigger.
Yeah. So it's like, I mean, this guy, and, you know, and he gets attacked. He can't stand it. They can't stand it that they get attacked for this. Yeah. You know, and I'm only going to go after people who, if you have some little podcast and you're talking about this, I don't care.
If I publicly go out and denounce Israel, bad things happen to me. Doesn't matter if I'm a Democrat or a Republican. Doesn't matter. Okay. If I go out and publicly denounce the United States of America, absolutely fucking nothing happens to me.
Nope.
Right. Nope. And it's not going to happen to me because Israel's going to do it. The people in my country are going to do it to me.
That's on behalf of another country, on behalf of another people.
Who can you not criticize tells you who's in charge, right? I mean, I can criticize the president, and I can criticize the last president. I called him President Potato Salad Brain. Nothing happened to me. I guarantee you that if I was on my regular course of operations was like the Israeli bad show, the amount of negative publicity I would have from that would be amazing. And I'm no one. If I'm actually someone, so if I'm a congressman, right, if I'm a CEO of a company, I can't, or this lady you said was on some board here in Texas, what she said wasn't even a criticism. If from what you told me, I don't know everything she said, but what I got out of this, I don't personally believe that this thing is the fulfillment of a prophecy. I don't give a fuck what the thing is. Right. I don't. That is a religious opinion. That's not even a geopolitical opinion. That is, I disagree with your take on theology and your outcasts. Like, what else was like that? Gee, that little spicy cold, as you call it. We can say it now. I haven't been demonetized in a long time for saying the word COVID. Right. We weren't allowed to say anything against the orthodoxy of that. And. Look who benefited from it. That's all I'm going to say. And you can figure out how this whole thing works. And to me, that was my moment where I said, I'm not going to keep pushing a string. Like when I realized about 80% of people in our population would literally have stuffed their thumb up their ass and walked around with it that way to prevent COVID if they had been told to do it. It was kind of like, okay, I can't deal with any of these people anymore. Because I think what will happen is we'll break off a segment of society and kind of criticize them. And then people say, well, they're against that. Well, no, we're against all of it. This just happens to be the piece that we're talking about right now. It's amazing. Like, you can say something negative about any group in the world, but you can't say anything negative about Israel as a country. And and the same people who will wisely say, I can criticize a black person in government without criticizing the black race, because I'm singling out this issue right here, will then do the same thing. And what I've just determined is the majority of people don't want anything approaching freedom or liberty. And that makes them the enemy of liberty. They're just all coming from different ways that they want to take away from it.
Well, you know, it makes them my enemy too. I mean, look. Yeah. I said this about the Bondi Beach shooting. I don't like violence at all. I don't want to see innocent people shot. But you know what? No Australian perpetrated that or was hurt or killed in that.
Hmm.
They just imported, they allowed groups to come into the country, and they're importing an ethnic conflict from around the world, from halfway around the world.
Correct.
This goes to immigration too. And it was one thing, you know, when I was a libertarian, I don't like law enforcement. So, why enforce the border? No. The reason you enforce the borders is because our government was set up in a certain way for certain people, for basically Northern European white Christians. That's who the Constitution was written for. The Constitution reflected their Constitution. Their inner constitution, who they are.
Yeah.
And when you import people who don't share that, well, it's one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to start changing the way you run your country because they can't keep up, or if you don't do that, then they're not going to be able to keep up and they're going to fail or leave. And you're going to figure out, well, we shouldn't bring people into the country who don't reflect the Constitution that as it was written. And since 1965, I mean, that's just completely off the table. I mean, you have whole groups that have just allowed to come in here and not even, it's not even that they don't assimilate. It's that they're hostile.
Yeah.
They'll be, you know, they're making hundreds. You will see people who've come in here, like especially some of the tech motherfuckers out in like some of the Indians out in Silicon Valley who are making millions of dollars, and they'll be like, I can't believe how racist this country is.
Yeah. And you weren't making millions of dollars where you came from. Right. Like you left where you came from. And I think we have a problem. The issue we have too is the volume and speed. So that, and every time I talk about this, people always want to say, oh, you mean balkanizing. And I'm no. I understand how you got there. Vulcanizing, right. That's the word. I mean the word I'm saying here. And what I come at that from is that the United States has always been this place like people, yes, can come from all around the world and become an American through an organized process, first of all. But there's a quantity issue from any given place at any given time. And when all of those people go to the same place, there's a comfort zone. And instead of getting a melting pot where we kind of have this uniform thing, like we made a brand new tire, we get, you're my age, but I also had a dad that ran a tire shop, so you might not have paid attention to this. Back in the 70s, 80s, we used to have a thing called recaps, where they actually kind of vulcanized, right, the belt back onto the tire. And the reason it failed is that doesn't work, and that belt would fly off, and if it happened to be like on a semi-truck or something, you had like an 80-pound hunk of rubber flying at 80 miles an hour hitting another car. And so there used a huge company called Robert Recaps back then that used to make this stuff. They were nationally advertised everywhere. And it just all went away overnight because it didn't work. When we bring in a huge population and they all settle in the same place and they have no need to branch outside of the community that came in with them, they all stay that way. And they bring the problem that they fled with them when they get here. And that doesn't really have to do with whether it's an Indian or a North African or an Asian or wherever these people are from. It isn't even a racial thing so much as it is a cultural thing that they're bringing that culture and all of its problems with them. And then we're told, of course, it's beautiful and wonderful and diverse and they can make America better. And really, they built a diverse. If they're so great, why does their country suck? Why is the place they're leaving a complete shithole when it's 100% of these people that whatever group it is, all of a sudden they're held up this way? Whereas immigration in this country traditionally was, well, I don't want to get into that because if we go back far enough, we get into things like bringing the Chinese to work on the railroad and the Irish and all. Kind of the same dynamic, but it was forced. But in that delta in between where it seemed to work pretty well, small amounts from different places all over, and then you were forced to integrate. And then you were forced to adopt the culture of the people that you coexisted with instead of bringing – and that didn't mean that you couldn't have your culture, like your food or your religion or whatever. But you know what I'm saying? Like you had to function within society. You had to learn the language. My wife's parents immigrated here after World War II from the Netherlands. And my father-in-law and my mother-in-law both told their family, we live in America now, we speak English. Like it wasn't, you don't even think about speaking anything but English because this is where we live now. And I feel like we've lost that immigrant value, if that makes sense.
Well, I think one of the reasons why when you tell somebody, you know, if your country, you know, if how come you couldn't make your country, because culture is downstream of race.
Yeah.
I mean, the people there, you know, there's a really good documentary. You can find it on YouTube. It's called Empire of Dust. And it's about these Chinese who went to Africa and, you know, they tried to set up a mining company.
Okay.
And they tried to get the Africans to work for them. This just doesn't work. I talked to a guy who, like, his job after he got out of the military doing some really spicy stuff, his job was to work in an African country, make sure that the water stayed on, the power stayed on, basically that the country ran while, you know, because there was no one there who could do it. Yeah. Have you, there's this, I can't remember what the name of the YouTube guy is, but, he went and built all these wells all over Africa. Okay. And he's like, oh, we're bringing fresh water to Africa.
They're shitting in their own wells.
And they left. And what happened? Their wells. I mean, India, the thing I always come back to Indians because they are so arrogant about being here. And we work in Silicon Valley now. Yeah. And we, you know, and we run Silicon Valley. It's like your country is hell.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never been there, but I know many people who've been there. And the first thing they think when they get there is, I can't wait to leave. And because, and why is that? Is it because of colonization? No, you know, actually, India was working pretty well under the Raj. When the British were there, it was, India worked, the British left. What's India today? I'm sorry.
I don't want to be there. I'll put it that
way. You can't import, you know, when the Irish came here, they had to assimilate. When the Italians came here, they had to assimilate. I'll leave that group out. but once you see groups, once you see groups that aren't Western, let's put it that way, are not Western or not European.
Yeah.
I mean, there you start having some real issues. You know, it's like just, you know, when Trump came in the first time, it was so much about the southern border.
Yeah.
And what's funny is now is, you know, we got that closed. But when you look at the southern border and you see the people coming over the southern border and then you compare them to like Somalis or when you compare them to Somalis or Indians, you're like, it's almost like it was a psyop. The Indians and the Somalis were a psyop to make you go, you know, the Guatemalans really aren't that bad. If you want to know how bad, I mean, look at Ontario. Go research Ontario. Ontario has become an Indian. I mean,
yes,
Canada has taken in 10 million immigrants in the last 10 years.
The entire demographic of Canada has completely flipped in 15 years. It's like 15 years and just look at the ratios. It's upside down in 15 years.
Did you hear about the and especially in Ontario, the doctor, the whole controversy with Indian doctors up there? They have diploma mills.
Oh, I know India.
And they were going to India and they weren't testing them. And they were making these people doctors in hospitals. And it's like, why are people dying? Why is the rate in hospital going up?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with, I mean, a lot of the people who are going to Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Anybody, I'm not a coder. I know a lot of coders. Coders will tell you now you have AI. They can, you know, AI can code for you. But it used to be 10 years ago, that you would just, they'd be like, my code's broken here. What can I do? They just go into some group chat and someone fixes it for them, copy, paste, boom, right in.
It's
not like these people are geniuses.
No.
They're just willing to do it for less.
You know, and on the thing, like, they can't run their own countries. We've seen this in other places. Panama is a perfect example. I served in Panama in the early 90s. And we were getting ready to give the whole canal zone back to the Panamanians. And I remember even being young as fuck. I was like 18 years old when I first got in country and I was 21 when I left. So I was very young. And I already was like, they can't run this. They're not going to be able to run this. So by the time you got into like the late 90s and I'm building my professional career, I remember people asking me about, like, once we finally pulled, you know, I think the 99 is when we pulled all the way out. Like, what's going to happen? I'm like, China's going to take it over. Like, how could you possibly know that? Because we're not. And I can look around the world and go, who has the money, the desire, and the ability to do this? And I could come up with, you know, maybe the Germans, but they're not going to do it. Maybe the English, probably not, but maybe, but they're not going to do it. The Chinese or the Japanese. That's it. Like, that's it. There is not another, there's not another country with the money, the wealth, and the talent to, the Panama Canal, even though it was built over 100 years ago, is an incredible engineering marvel. It takes incredible logistics and engineering to keep it maintained and keep it running. There's not anybody else that can do this. Maybe, I don't know, maybe the Saudis or some shit. I don't know, right? Like some conglomeration. And that wasn't going to happen. So it has to be China. Guess who it was? It was China. Because they can't run. It's already there. Somebody already built it, but they can't run it. And I think that's something we've seen in a lot of places. I get the whole anti-colonizer attacks from some of my own audience. Sometimes they say, the reason that country's a shithole is because we colonized it. Or, you know, Somalia.
Countries get better when we colonize them.
It was countries a shithole before. Better. And now it's a shithole again, and they've been left. They've been given control of their country back, and it's a shithole. I'm thinking there's a problem locally. I think this is a local problem. I don't think Somalia is a shithole because of Rome. I really don't. It doesn't make sense to me. You might feel good saying it, but you can't explain it in a way that makes sense to anybody using logic.
I think the average IQ in Somalia is in the mid-60s.
68.
They can't even entertain hypotheticals.
Yeah.
That's why the whole libertarian thing, libertarians are like, oh, let them come in and everything. I'm like, dude, your whole ideology is like hypotheticals. They can't entertain hypotheticals. It's like you can't if once you go below a certain IQ. Go ahead.
I was just saying, if I have to explain the problem with the modern libertarian is they don't understand what you would call order of operations. All right. So, you know, when you were in school, PEDMOS, right? You got my dear Aunt Sally, right? You got your multiply, divide, add, subtract in order. And if you don't follow the order of the operations, you can't get the equation right. So their whole idea is there should be basically no government or this entire like a minarchist state. Okay, great. Okay. If you're going to do that and you're going to do it by deconstructing the existing state to have any hope of it being in any way okay, you have to go in a specific order of operations. And probably the last thing you tear down is your national borders. So, like, this is the last step in the equation, and you want to do it first just because it makes the government weak. And that makes no sense, but when I look at what's happened to the LP over the last 25 years, not that it was ever in a great state, but what's happened in 25 years is staggering with the official LP. It doesn't surprise me. Again, I'm back to like, unless you find like life on Mars or some shit, I'm not surprised anymore.
Yeah. You know, people, I used to make fun of the LP because, you know, it was like in 2024, they run the gay candidate, yeah. And, you know, and it's all like this pro gay stuff. Oh, and then I did like deep research into the GOP. Holy crap. You want to talk about a gay organization? Oh my God. I'm just going to do
work. Lindsey Graham. Like,
I just had, Father Emmanuel Lemelson on my show. He was a hedge fund manager, a Eastern Orthodox hedge fund manager. And he basically revealed corruption. So they arrested him because, you know, when you reveal corruption, when you reveal their corruption, you know, and he was brought up on charges by the Security Exchange Commission. He said he was sitting there in court with his lawyers. He said he leaned over to his lawyers and said, tell me what you notice about the whole prosecution team. They're all gay.
Huh.
They're all gay men.
Huh.
I mean, the government is replete with homosexuals. Why? They have nothing else going on in their life. They have a grudge. They want power. They want whatever it is, mm-hmm. whatever it is. And that's a lot of the GOP. It is not a leftist meme. I mean, it is a leftist meme because the leftists talk about how whenever there's like a Republican convention somewhere, the Grindr app crashes. That's actually real.
Is it?
Actually really happens. Because it's like, and I tell Christians, I'm like, if you're still calling this a Christian country and you think the Republican Party works for you, Do you think God is blessing this thing that is overrun by homosexuals and yeah. sodomites and pedophiles and, I mean, and corrupted people, people who have been compromised, people who have been, look, it's over. This whole national, this whole, you know, experiment in constitutional republic, it's over. There is not, I mean, read the emails. I mean, the guy who stands behind Donald Trump, 3 out of 4 times he speaks in public, his name is Howard Lutnick.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. This is a guy in 2005 who said, oh, I met Jeffrey Epstein and I knew there was something wrong. I never had anything to do with him again. Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you have an email talking about how you're going to stop by Little St. James Island to say hi. Oh, and by the way, we have 8 children with us, and you list the ages of each child. I don't know, Jack, you have kids. When you went over a friend's, if you told a friend you were coming over their house and you were bringing your kids, did you list out the ages of all the kids?
No.
It seems really weird to do something like that. Not to mention, he lied. He basically said, oh, I knew. And then these are from like 2012. This is after he said that Epstein gave him the creeps. It's like, and what about all these people who were still associating with this guy after he, well, really didn't do jail time down there, if you know anything about his conviction in Florida. I mean, he left every day. I think he went back and slept there like one night a week. Oh, and who happened to be the person who visited him the most? Former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak. I mean, come on, people. No, this doesn't work anymore. This doesn't, pretending you're going to vote your way out of this on the national level.
Yeah.
I think voting locally and even statewide still makes a difference. Can make a difference. Not saying it always does.
But national?
What are you talking about? Come on. These people are compromised. They are bought and sold. And some of them may be have committed some of the most evil things you've ever thought. You don't want to think about.
I almost see it as like a, you know, they have these like elite universities and they have like skull and bones and shit like that. And there's always like this kind of humiliation ritual so that you become fraternal brothers, right? Like where everybody has a secret that the society is aware. The society's not secret, right? The society has secrets within its own membership. And that way everybody in some way is beholden to someone else. And when I look at ops like the Epstein op, and no one will ever convince me it's not an op, I kind of see it like that, like and that maybe it actually begins more with, you know, the hot 28-year-old prostitute. And it's the way our ambassadors work with the CIA. So like if I'm an ambassador and I'm over in this foreign country and you work at the embassy that I work at, you're from the host nation, I might ask you to do something for me that's not technically illegal, right? Like get me a schedule or something. But there's a way I could do that for myself. Right. I could do that for myself, but I'm asking you to do it. So now I've gotten you to do something and you took that first step. And then I start getting to know you and I find out that you have a kid. And then I say something like, you know, like, hey, your daughter just got pulled over, but we could make the problem go away. And then eventually I co-opt you. And then I turn you over as an asset to a handler within the CIA. I see the Epstein op looking an awful lot like that. Like you want to play in the giant pool of national politics, this entryway that you're funneled through no matter what party you're in, you know, and what you were talking about earlier with like the funding of the wars on both sides and stuff. An analogy for that would be, imagine this, Peter, I give you this magical power. You can bet on any sporting game you want. Doesn't matter if it's baseball, basketball, whatever. You get 5-to-1 odds both ways. Always. So you can go bet, you know, the Braves are playing, I don't know, the Yankees, and you can put money on both teams the exact same amount and get paid 5-to-1 no matter who wins. You're going to bet on all the games, aren't you? And I see a lot of what goes on in politics to be that way. Since whoever wins will be beholden, I can basically make 5-to-1 leverage bets everywhere. And that's what I think happens. They get these guys in these compromising positions and they don't care if they're a Republican or a Democrat. They only care, how far do I let you come off the talking points that are approved for your side before I smack you down. And I've always got something over your head.
My buddy Ryan Dawson, he wrote his first article about the Epstein Network in 2006. It's almost 20 years ago. And he makes the point that this is more about money and power. And he believes that, like, the illicit and illegal and disgusting sex with children and stuff like that is a perk. And one of the ways he explains that is everybody talks about how Jeffrey Epstein's townhouse had cameras in it.
Yeah. Well,
how are you going to blackmail somebody with video from your own house? Okay, so you know that this person is doing this in your house.
Yeah, yeah.
And the video is clearly going to show it's in your house. And he thinks, and I have a tendency to agree with him, in many cases, this isn't about blackmail because of the sex. It's about blackmail because they're taking money. And as soon as you take money, you're basically in. But also, if you do start become part of this network, this pedophile network, you're really in. There's no getting out. You know, you've basically bought in. You know, it's like going to Bohemian Grove. What did Nixon say? Oh, biggest faggoty thing I've ever seen. You can't believe these guys. Nixon's at. But you know, you're going there and you've basically said, look, I'm in the club.
Yeah.
And how do you get out of that? I mean, look, Robert Maxwell.
Well, gang, you're jumped in. You got to get jumped out. But getting jumped out is suiciding yourself.
And Robert Maxwell, you know, apparently he was like demanding more money, like money from the Mossad. He was like, I need this much more. And they were like, we're just sick and tired. You know, they're going to get sick and tired of dealing with you. Yeah. Look at Jeffrey Epstein. Yeah. Anybody who believes Jeffrey Epstein killed himself is insane. And as my buddy Daryl Cooper, Martyr Maid, said, he said, I knew this country was done, was over when Jeffrey Epstein killed him, when Jeffrey Epstein, quote unquote, killed himself, but died in federal custody. And the overwhelming majority of America did not march on Washington and basically French Revolution every politician.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, even though they didn't march on Washington, I think that the clear majority of Americans believe he did not, in fact, kill himself. My wife, who is so divorced from all of this, and in spite of being married to me, right, is like, the day that happened, she goes, no, he didn't. I mean, it was an instant, like, no, he didn't. No, like, that didn't happen. And so, to me, like, she's my barometer. When I say something like that, I gotta remember who I am and what I know and how I act and my bias and whatever. When she's in line with me, instantly, without me saying a word, I'm like, I'm probably right now, because that's like having a completely independent computer network with its own sensors giving you the same reading. That is completely engineered differently. I promise you, my wife is engineered very differently than I am. And to me, like, the country's over because they know it and they're still tolerating it. That's actually worse than being deceived, because you know what we're dealing with. And tell me this hasn't cross your radar too. Have you noticed how the left, as soon as they thought they could get Trump with this, they're all worried about pedophiles. Pedophile, pedophile, pedophile. These are the fucking people that created the term MAP, minor attracted person, because they didn't want to offend the pedophiles. But now they care. And to me, when I start seeing things like that, like, I agree, like, there is no fixing this. And I hate that, because I'm a solutions oriented person. I've always tried to put about 80% of my content out of what you can do and 20% about what's wrong. And I don't have a solution to this at the macro level, period. It's above my pay grade, as we used to say in the military. I don't have a way to do that. I agree with you. Some pushback can be done locally. And I think that involves finding the right place in a defensible position. And basically Sun Tzu's Art of War, like, you choose the time and the terrain and place of your battle. Because if you try to play on their field, you're going... It's not even you're going to lose. You already lost. It's done. You're trying to win a game that's not even being played anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you will hear a lot of people, on the right, and I'm not talking about conservatives. I'm talking about I'm talking about the like real right wingers that will be like, we can't give up the cities and everything like that. And I understand that the cities are power centers, they're cultural centers as well. But I think at this point with what we're going through, if you think that you're going to fight back, you probably don't want to be in there for a, you don't want to be in there with a family. Yeah, it'd be for like young single people who, because things are going to get bad. We have historical precedent for this. I won't get into that. But you know, I don't know what it's going to take back country, because it's so corrupt at this point that, you know, me and my buddy Thomas, we podcast a lot, probably once a week. And what we talk about is look, you're just going to have to make your stand locally. And really, if you start building enough local cadres and that becomes, you know, a thing where people are like, yeah, we need to concentrate into this one place, you know, don't do like the Branch Davidians and all live in the same house. But, you know, but if you're like all in the same center and you get one of your buddies elected sheriff, your buddy elected mayor, something like that, I mean, this really may be the future for a very long time, because I mean, this regime can, you know, people, you know, libertarians have been, you know, the Peter Schiffs of the world have been saying, oh, the dollar is going away anytime now. They've been saying that since like 1972. Somehow they've figured out a way to keep this thing going. Can it go forever? No, but it could go for another 120 years. I mean, there were people before the fall of Rome, you know, before the empire fell, there were people 120 years, 150 years before saying, oh, Rome has fallen. But sometimes it just takes a long time for it to absolutely crash. And you could be looking at that now. So what do you do in the meantime? Well, you organize locally, you organize with people who share your values, share your commitments, and you also concentrate on trying to build what comes next. You know, agorists talk about that, but you know, it's really hard for like heavy industry, things like that, to build outside the system. But there are little things that you can build outside the system. You can start doing things that are complete, and because it's become so degenerate, they're just going to become weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. Like I said, it's going to take time, but I think you can really start building what comes next. You know, a lot of anarchists used to be like, oh, we just need the government to fall, and then everybody's going to accept, you know, everybody's going to want to be what I am. Well, no, that's not the way that works. No. You have to have something in place that people, you know, a friend of mine said a few years ago, and it was so simple, made so much sense to me. If everything fell apart right now, the next people who would be in charge are the people who could feed people. The person who'd be in charge, the people who'd be in charge, are people who can just feed people.
Yep.
And it really is that simple. This thing is falling apart. Make your stand where you are. Start building. Start doing what you need to do. But most importantly, stop with the radical individualist stuff. You got to get together with people. You got to trust people. And you have to be able to be like, okay, this is someone I can call who can be here in 10 minutes if I need them. And I think that's what's most important. These people, these monsters, have created a network where they come to each other's aid. They get people fired. They get them appointed to boards. They get, you know, they dismember people in the friggin' embassies, you know, around the world because they pissed somebody off. Not saying you're going to do that because that's evil, but you definitely want to have people that you can rely upon that you know are going to be there. And not only them, start training their kids have to be start training to have the same exact kind of attitude. And no, you're not going to go to a super zip code when you get older, and you're going to stay right here, and you're going to do just like our ancestors did, stayed in one place and built until it just became unlivable that they had to leave and go somewhere else.
Yeah. I do think we're in this point of this kind of hyper local system. And I think that what you're talking about, though, with the libertarians and anarchists is what I called Messiah syndrome. Like when you first realize, look, I've always thought there was something wrong, and this very clearly articulates the problem, thereby it must be the solution. And then you think, well, if everybody knew, then everybody would, but they don't, and they're not gonna. And I mean, I've said that for years, no matter how much of an anarchist I consider myself in principle from a pragmatic view, I am not the majority. In fact, I'm an infinitesimally small minority of a minority. Most people do not think in individualistic views at all. And I think there has to be a blend, because without some level of individual sovereignty, then what are you fighting for? But without some sort of collective force, you can't fight. And that sounds like a contradiction, but I think it's like, it's why libertarians are their own worst enemy. If you go and listen to 20, just they're all libertarians talk, they will do nothing but argue. They will agree on almost nothing. If you put a bunch of Republicans in a room, they'll argue some, but they'll have a whole shitload of things. They all agree we all need to do this. And if you listen to liberals, there's almost no internal argument. It's everybody gets on board with the same. These are the three things. And that to me has always put the more you move toward liberty, unfortunately, politically, more at a disadvantage. Absolutely at a disadvantage. And I put it this way, when I did a whole series on Alinsky's Rules for Radicals and how they could be applied from any direction, not just necessarily by the left.
Of course.
And that's the playbook that's being used against you. But what I said during that series was the illusion that keeps the right completely out of power is the belief that they've held power any time in the last 50 years, because they haven't. They yeah. might have held the Congress or the Senate or the Congress, the Senate, and the White House, but they haven't held power. They haven't held fucking power because the left controls the actual apparatus. 90% of
the Washington generals. They're right. The Washington generals.
Yeah, they exactly are. To make it look like there's a game, right? Except yeah. everybody doesn't know, like everybody knows what the generals are. The people don't know, the especially on the right and the left, because they have to keep fighting, right? They're like, imagine people that like actually put money on the Globetrotters games. That's how the average voter is today. They have no understanding whatsoever what's going on. But like the apparatus of power, like the bureaucracy. Well, 80% of the bureaucrats are leftists, at least, if not 90, right? So that's where the real power, that's the people that actually carry out things day to day. Academia is the biggest seat of power that we have. They've controlled everything since the 30s, at least, but really since the 70s. I mean, full on since the 70s, and the media. So if you've got the bureaucracy, the media, and academia, then it doesn't, it's the whole Rockefeller thing, like if I control the money, I don't give a fuck who runs the country. It's the same type of thing. You control the mass education and marketing and messaging. Then you control everything. So even when it looks like the generals are going to win, they're not going to win. It's not going to happen, Pete. I don't know if you know that, but they've never won one game.
No, I think they've won one game. I think they let them actually win one game once.
Really?
But, yeah. But
the people that win had to be pissed.
Oh. The Ernst Junger released a book in 1977. He was a World War I and World War II German vet. And in World War I, he wrote a book called Storm of Steel. It's probably the best book on World War I I've ever read. But Junger, in his 1977 book, Jungspiel, he talks about the concept of the anarch. It's a post-apocalyptic book. And the concept of an anarch is that you're a yeoman farmer warrior. You're not out there by yourself, but you have to be able to take care of yourself by being like a yeoman farmer and also be a warrior too. And that's what I think the future is a bunch of anarchs coming together. And anarch has nothing to do with anarchy. It's a term he used for the novel. Okay. And you have a bunch of people who come together and you plan and you just basically are yeoman farmer warriors together. And, you know, in a post-apocalyptic world, you're going to need that number. You know, there is power in numbers. In many ways, we are living in a post-apocalyptic world. Sam Francis came up with this, a term called the narco-tyranny. And basically what it means is that the government decides that it is going to allow chaos by letting the criminals run loose. We're not going to do anything about them, but we will do something to the people who would seek to try to restore order. And in an anarcho-tyranny, the concept of the anarch, the yeoman farmer warrior coming together with other people to protect each other, is a brilliant concept. Is a concept that people need to look at going forward.
Yeah, you made me think of a video I recorded so long ago. I lived in Arkansas, and it was, everybody was talking about without rule of law, without rule of law, without rule of law, in the prepper space at the time. And I was like, you guys better worry about EROL, excessive rule of law. And that's what you're describing, where the people that are actually causing the problem get away with it. And that's what people think of without rule of law. But at least if it was in that situation and we had guys out marauding and stealing shit and whatever, and you came to my neighborhood, you're going to get lit the fuck up. And if that was acceptable, then you'd come to some sort of stasis, right? Like, don't go over there because those guys will fuck you up back. But if you have a situation where those people get away with what they're doing, but the people that defend themselves then face the authority of the tyranny of a nation, that's what people say, like, if you want anarchy, go to Somalia or whatever. No, that's not fucking anarchy, right? Because there are still the enforcers that have the clout of the state that will come in and pick a side and put their thumb on the scale. And that is where we're headed for in a big way. And that's why, you know, when people are like, but it makes the government more powerful to deport third worlders. I'm sorry. You're going to have to explain that to me, because I think it's exactly the opposite. Having lots of third worlders in your country is actually what empowers government. And I don't know where anybody comes off with that. I've had so many people in people that you and I used to have in our orbit all the time, by the way, Peter. That say that, like, it's actually how they're going to have the full police state. It's actually how they're going to have the full surveillance state by deporting Guatemalans. And I'm sorry, that's a big leap for me. You have to come to Logic Town with me, and you have to explain to me how that's going to work, because I can't see it.
Well, what they would say is that as soon as, if you deport everyone and close the borders, now, you know, those borders are being used against you. Yeah. Now you can't leave. Yeah. I mean, it's like, okay, well, I'm kind of okay. You know, as long as the government doesn't get tyrannical.
I'm talking about, I probably don't want to leave.
Yeah. It's like, you know, there are people right now making a living by teaching Americans how to go and move to Ecuador and countries like that, because people mm-hmm. want to leave. You know, why do people want to leave? It's not because, I mean, I don't think maybe some of them are, it has something to do with their ideological opinions of government, but it's become in many places unlivable. You know, it's why I live where I live, because where I live is very livable. It's not transient. People, you know, some of my friends that I know here, their families have lived here for 200 years. They're not going anywhere. They don't want to leave. And, you know, when you have people who own a lot of land in one place, and when they get a little bit of money, they buy more land. They're investing in their area. They don't want their area to go to crap. You don't have that in suburbs. You don't have that in exurbs. You definitely don't have that in cities. I'm not telling people to leave those places. I'm just telling people to understand exactly what the conditions are where you live. Most people don't even take that into consideration. They don't take into consideration. You know, I used to live in South Florida, Fort Lauderdale area. Transient. People come and go. Just come and go. Some people don't even live there the whole year round. They snowbird. They go back to Canada. They go back to New York. They go back to different places. It's very transient. People act very differently when they're in vacation mode. People will do, when people go on vacation, they will do things they don't normally do where they're from. And when you have a transient area, a lot of people are in vacation mode. It becomes very dangerous. And unless you can be somewhere and you can, what we got here? I tell people all the time about, okay. Unless you can be somewhere where there is stability. I mean, come on. Come on. It's, yeah. You need, human beings need, especially Europeans, people of European descent, they want stability. They don't want constant change.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other thing too is, like, you're talking about this community where these people have been, your family's been here 200 years. The reality is any community, and that could be a town, a county, a state, a country, right? Any geographic based community is either growing or dying, right? It's almost impossible to be in a perfect state of stasis where if the population of your town was 2000 today, 50 years from now, it's still 2000 and it didn't really move up or down. It didn't go up and begin to decline, or it didn't decline and it's coming back. It's not linear. So you need some growth of most communities to at least maintain a stasis long term, if that makes sense. Where does the growth come from? And what you're describing here actually sounds a lot like towns that I'm familiar with, like one I grew up in, that's been in a decline because you can't import and all you're doing is exporting. So the population of Pottsville, where I grew up in high school, is going down, not so much because people aren't reproducing, which is what they'll say, but because the people that are reproducing are having children, and the children that want a future look around this coal town and go, it ain't here. So they leave. And the country is now doing that. That's what you're describing. People that are like, these are productive people that are going to get citizenship in El Salvador or Guatemala or wherever they're going to do this, right? That is not what a poor American's not doing that. These are entrepreneurs. These are retirees that have lots of spendable capital. That's who's doing the second passport thing. Why are they leaving? They're leaving for the same reason I left my little coal town. I want more choice than I have here. I want to keep more of my property, more of my money, because a lot of these countries, they may not be as capitalist as we supposedly are, but you actually keep more of your own money. One way or another, you keep more of your own money. And so people are making that decision. So what has the country done? Well, since we're not reproducing and having enough people that are reproducing and staying to grow our population, we're importing. We're importing people from India. We're importing people from South America. We're importing people from Africa and Asia. And we're doing that. I believe that the biggest driver of that is that we are in a population decline. I think that's one of the things. One of the few things Elon Musk has dead on. We are in a population decline, especially in the Western world, if you want to call it that. Did we lose you, Pete? Pete's. We can't hear you, Pete. Did you?
I'm sorry. I was muted. Yeah, you cut out on me and I missed like the last 30 seconds. You were talking about why people, they're importing.
Yeah. What I was saying is we're now importing people because we do not have enough reproduction. And I think that if you are the global elite and you want control of society, you can't have a declining population. You need a certain number of serfs, we'll call them. And it doesn't matter whether they're direct serfs, like they're actually doing work for ship money, or they're on the dole. But you need that segment of society as part of a control mechanism.
And that must be it, because when people tell me, oh, we're importing all these people, well, I'm talking to people who are getting fired because AI has taken their job. People are contacting me. So it's like, if we need people to work, how come? Well, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah, and I think you've seen a lot of companies using the excuse of AI to fire people because the economy really is that bad and their bottom line is that bad. Oh, we can just use, we're going to fire 8,000 people the only reason that you would keep importing people is because if you're an elite, we know this, the more chaos you have, the more people need you, more people are going to look to you for answers. And that's what importing people from, cultures and races that don't match up with Western ideology and belief and structure does. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what to, beyond localism at this point, there really is, there are no answers. I mean, I will say this though, you know, if you don't think that change can be had, just look at El Salvador.
Hmm.
You know, I went to El Salvador. I was in El Salvador for 10 days last year. San Salvador is pretty much feels safer than New York and a lot of big cities when you're walking around. They have a big police presence, civil guard presence, and even military presence, which is more of a, you know, fuck around and find out at this point.
Yeah.
But the change can be made. It just takes will.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people can say, well, we don't know who's behind Bukele, who gave him these ideas. Yeah, I don't care about that. I care about the fact that I went to a country and I didn't have to look over my shoulder when I was walking in the streets at night in a city. But change can be had. It just takes will. And there is no will here to change anything because the people who would have the power to change things, well, that may weaken their power. That may weaken their wealth. We're in this cycle where anybody who gets elected, especially to national office, is going there to loot the treasury, is just going there to get whatever they want. I've talked to you. I interviewed way back, a lobbyist, worked for one of the biggest lobby firms in DC. And he said the reason he ended up in DC was he was in Texas and he helped somebody get elected to Congress. He said, and this guy ran as Ron Paul. And as soon as he got to Washington, D.C., he just turned on a dime and just started taking the money, started doing all the things that every single one of them do. So he was like, well, I'm here. I got a couple contacts on the Hill now. I'll just get a job in a lobby firm. And then he was able to see exactly how the sausage is made and, you know, talk about it. And I heard Thomas Massey listen to that episode and was like, yeah, it's pretty much 100% how that works. But yeah, I mean, national politics at this point, you know, just to reiterate, there are no answers there. And as a matter of fact, I don't recommend anybody goes up there to try to change it. It's going to end up changing you. It'll end up changing you, or you will be treated horribly.
Yeah.
Horribly.
Yeah. You know, the famous cartoon of the guy with the giant fork sticking in the light socket, and the light socket says socialism. And the guy says, everybody that did that before you got hurt. And he says, everybody else did it wrong. I think that's federal office, right? Which I guess socialism fits pretty well with that anyway. But I mean, really, it's like the best person in that machine will either be corrupted or at best miserable. Right. That's Massey. Massey's got to be a miserable person right now. And it may be the tragedy of losing his wife that he's like, well, fuck it. I got nothing else. I'm going to fight these bastards. Right. Because the way that man has been treated for doing exactly the shit that the people treating him that way claim they want to do is unbelievable to me how bad it is. And the guy sticks with it. Like, I'm sure right now he could go make a living for himself a hell of a lot easier than he's going to continue to do by fighting.
Well, look at Marjorie Taylor Greene. My wife's actually from her district, and she was very familiar with her when she was coming up and everything. People are like, oh, why don't you stay there and fight? I don't hold anything against her for wanting to get out of there. Yeah, I honestly believe if you look at some of the things that were happening in her personal life, that I think her soul got a little bit corrupted being up there. And, you know, I think she got out, and her getting out now and speaking. And I know people hate her because she's like, you know, she's like, look, I was trying to push it for the Epstein files, and Trump told me, she's saying that Trump told her, you know, some of my friends will be hurt if the Epstein files come out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, man, I'm what? Not.
Yeah.
I mean, look, the people who are attacking Massey the most right now are just the biggest Trump humpers.
Yeah,
they're just the people who are like, Trump's going to save us. Trump's here to save us. Look, I can list a whole bunch of good things that Trump did, but guess what? There's going to be an election this year. There's going to be an election in 2028. It's going to be an election 2 years after that and 4 years after that. You live in a system where, and they're not even passing laws. I mean, he has both the Senate and the House right now. He could be codifying this in laws, even if that meant something. At least yeah. you codify it in law. It's harder to ignore. I mean, not really, but I mean, if you were being serious, he's just signing things which the next president can just sign away
Unsigned.
With one stroke of the pen.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
like, okay, the border's closed right now. What happens if Gavin Newsom gets in 2028?
Open
the border's right open again.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Even if somebody went in there to, you know, and wanted to become a true Article II president where all power is invested in the office, they're probably going to get killed. They'll probably, you know, they'll die of food poisoning or something.
They need to bring back the food taster like they had in Roman times.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody didn't put hemlock in the food and shit. Like, hey, you eat that burrito, and if it works out, I'll eat the next one. Like, I mean, seriously, I know people like, no, I have seen people killed for very insignificant amounts of money. When you talk about control of the most powerful empire that's ever existed, that's not a big leap for somebody to murder somebody over it. It really isn't.
Murder kids, murder women, murder. I mean, these people do not care. You know, it came out that the IDF even admitted this, even if the numbers are real. They said, oh, about 76,000 Palestinians have died since we started our response to October 7th. Yeah, 70, I think they said 85% of them were civilians. So it's what, roughly 65,000 civilians? I mean, come on. I mean, I thought World War II was supposed to solve all of this. You know, we didn't have wars like this anymore. You know, it's like, yeah, and then we become so black and white. I talk about the Palestinians. People are like, oh, so you're pro Hamas now? Yeah, shut up. I mean, shut up. Come on. You're so low IQ, and you've bought, I mean, basically what you're doing is you bought into what's called Hasbara. It's Israeli propaganda. It's just basically this whole school of propaganda where if you criticize anyone, you're for whatever is the opposite there.
Correct.
And don't even play with me. Try to play that with me.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And that is, this binaryism has been the greatest tool of control implemented in my life, I would say, to where there's such a political tribalism that if you go off the reservation on a single talking point from your side, you're immediately the other side. And right. kind of like one of my points of pride is I get called a libtard and a Trumper, MAGA, whatever, on the same day for the same thing from different people. Like, I put one thing up and you're a libtarded idiot and you're a magtard or whatever, a maggot or whatever the hell that terminology they use for that. Like, I said the same thing. Both of you heard the same thing, and you've gone to completely different corners of the ring to attack me from. And that just means I think you're calling it down the center. I mean, I when the whole shit happened, the last person that got, that guy that got shot up in Minnesota, what's his name? Pretty, right. I was on vacation, so I don't know if you know this, but when I go on vacation, I actually go on vacation. I actually unplug, and I actually like see to my own life and my wife and my family and do things with them. I don't sit while I'm on vacation. I don't sit in front of watching CNN and Fox News all day long. So when this all started, I had people asking me, and I basically went on social and I said, look, I'm on vacation. I haven't really dug into this much yet. The guy looks like he was a dick and causing trouble. That doesn't mean he should have been shot. And right now, I don't know, and I won't have an opinion till I get back and actually review the facts. You're sucking cops' dicks. You're a bootlicker. Like, where did we get into a world? Like, so this, at this point, I haven't even taken a side. I've just said, since I don't have the information yet, I can't give an opinion. And you're already put into, you're one of them. And once we get there, I think that you talk about a divided nation. How much more divided could you? That the person says, since I don't know, I don't have an opinion yet, gets attacked. And, you know, my summation of it after I got a look at everything was, the guy was a fucking idiot. He's probably a fucking commie. I'm not going to, like, lay flowers down at his grave or something. But I'm still not sure he should have been shot because he didn't have a gun on him when they shot him. But I don't know. Of course, that now I'm an Uber bootlicker or whatever. I mean,
what does that mean? When people call you bootlicker, what does that do? Oh, you're going to kick me out of your group chat?
Yeah,
I mean, what is that? It's like you think that term has any what's the point of that? You know, it's like,
that group has done with bootlicker with like what the left has done with racist. You've so overused the term that
these are people. But these are people who exist completely online.
Yeah.
They don't get out. They don't build social capital with people. They're not, you know, especially the people who use bootlicker. That's normally like libertarian anarchist types. Yeah. They're individualists. They're not doing anything in real life. They're the sports fan who's, you know, yelling at athletes from the bleachers, you know, is like, oh, you suck and everything like that. Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, that basically, you know, someone calling you a bootlicker online is about the same as like when some world class athlete is being called, you know, called something from the stands.
You suck.
Doesn't matter.
Bomb, right?
who cares? You know, it's like, I mean, if somebody I respected came, well, first of all, someone I respected would not do that publicly.
Yeah.
They would come to me privately.
Yeah.
But if somebody I respected came to me privately and said, you know, you really should rethink this, I'm going to listen to them. It's not going to be some rando using an anon name on the internet that I'm going to really care about what they have to say. I mean, what does it matter?
How much people think that you care about their opinion? Like, you know, I'll never listen to you again. I don't know. You're like 20. I was doing this when you were 2 shit in your pants. And I what makes you think I care now about your opinion about this thing? Like and they do. And then I think the worst thing you can do to that person is be very clear by not even responding to them that you don't care about their opinion. Then they get really mad. Then they go completely, it's like they feel a right not only to be enraged, but to have their rage like in some way pampered or countered or whatever. And I'll often tell those people either nothing or I'll be like, you're retarded. And they'll say, well, that's a very intellectual comeback. Well, it's exactly as intellectual as it needed to be to respond to you, right?
If you've never rolled a sports car or had a woman pull a knife on you because she was jealous, I don't care about your opinion.
I have rolled a sports car.
That's good enough, man.
I have rolled a sports car. I've had some conflicts with women things, but I've never had a knife pulled on me. I did have a girl pull a knife on me once, but it wasn't quite for that reason.
Yeah, well, you were in the wrong neighborhood.
Not really. She was just a nut. She was just a complete nut, but it didn't.
And sometimes, you date those.
Yeah, that's the hot crazy matrix thing, which is probably one of the best things ever done. So, man, what? We're like an hour 40 into this. Mostly, we've bitched.
Yeah.
What is your advice for people, like going forward in their lives?
Find people of like mind. Find people with the same values. Find people who are. Believe me, there are a lot of people out there who feel the same way you did. A couple guys approached me back in 2022 about starting a fraternity, just to support our guys. And I did it and we started it. And now we're in 40 states. It's called the Old Glory Club. And it's basically a fraternity to, have men come together, support each other. And, you know, help build for the future. And that's probably the most important thing you can do. Concentrate on yourself. Pay off, get out of debt. If you own a house, pay off your house, get that thing paid off as quick as possible. If you have the ability to do it, even in a very small area, start growing some food. And yeah, just get together with like-minded people and build something. Build something and make sure that everybody in there is on the same page as far as knowing exactly the nature of the regime that has been ruling over us. You know, so yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's it. You have to start building something. And until, if you're just out there on your own, it's going to be very hard for you to, especially if you're someone who looks and you recognize exactly what the regime is and what this country has turned into, it's going to be very hard to have any hope for the future. But the more people that you meet who understand what you're going through and have your same opinions and are willing to put in the time to try and build something, then you can, you know, you can start looking towards the future and having real hope.
I would agree. And I think the biggest thing that you said in there that I take from that is build something, right? And I agree with finding people of like mind and working together and all. But when I think build something, the first thing I think is build something economically. Like if you're a JOB person, then you're a JOB person, but then build an amazing career and manage your money well and build financial liberty into your life. I think the better route for those that can do it is some form of entrepreneurship, because then you call your own shots. Like, I didn't give a shit what somebody said about me or did about me during COVID. Like, it affected my life not at all. Actually, my revenue went up, you know, during like a bad time. And I had the ability to adjust and adapt to the situation because I was calling the shots for myself. The other thing about when you get entrepreneurial, that is a great way to be part of a community, because if you're big enough, one, you're giving people jobs. People like people who give people jobs. But you also have freedom. You have freedom not only to act like you truly want to act, but you have freedom because you have time freedom. You can make time freedom. So you can get involved in things at that local level that the average person, it's not that they wouldn't, it's they can't. You know, I think of like my son and my daughter-in-law. They've got, you know, my grandkids are 9 and freaking 15 now, and they've got their activities, and both of them have full-time jobs. So they work all week long, and then they've got extracurricular activities and sports and all that shit. Like, where would my son fit in, you know, a weekly meeting to make things better in his town? And I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying it would take he'd have to give up some time with his family for that, because his boss ain't going to let him do it. But if he was running his own company like I do, if I decide, hey, I want to every Friday go down, okay, I don't work Fridays now. Or I design my business around that schedule so that I can take 2 hours to be part of something. And so I think the more that you can build economic liberty, the more you have of all liberty in your life, as long as you don't do it in such a way that the action itself compromises you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, one of the good things, we really have a diverse group in the Old Glory Club. We have people who own businesses, and we have people who are, right now we're in the process of getting our paperwork for a 501c3 to send, it's basically a law school fund to start sending people to law school, because you know, it's become very clear in the last few years that lawfare is going to be a big part of the future, and having lawyers on your side. I mean, we have lawyers, obviously, that are already part of the club, many, but getting more young men ready for the future. And the, you know, just, you know, whether it be, you know, and Old Glory Club is not a political organization, we're a nonprofit, but outside of that, we can not under the Old Glory Club banner, we have people who are organizing politically locally. Mm-hmm. We're doing really well in Tennessee. Alabama is doing really good, doing really well. Other states, Virginia just had an election that was wonderful. but the, you know, this is the thing is when you bring in people of diverse, when you have people of diverse skills and backgrounds, and, you know, some people just like me who, you know, have ideas and can rally people to join and, you know, join or die kind of thing, you know, together, you know, 13 pieces together are stronger than 13 separate as the original join or die was. Yeah, I think that's really important, but you're right. You know, making sure that you're financially, it's why I said get out of debt. Why I said it's, you just have to, you have to be able to do, you have to be able to not be under waiting for the shoe to drop, waiting for, you know, if you lose a job or if there's a dip in your business that you're not going to be able to pay the bills. You got to get out of debt. And then you get out of debt, you're really on the right track. Anyone who's out of debt knows, you know, the weight just comes right off of you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the only debt I have in my life is mortgage. And, you know, I have a fairly small mortgage for my house and it's at 3%. And I've always looked at that as if I can't do better than 3% with my money, I don't deserve the money. So I'm okay with that. But we don't have a car payment. You know, yeah. We don't have credit card payments.
We don't do that shit.
Like literally I had to actually change my advice for my audience over the years. When I first came on board, I was like, no credit cards, fuck miles, all that shit. The only thing that made me back off of that is I travel and it's gotten to the point you cannot rent a fucking car.
Yeah.
You can't do it. Like I used
to so many things you can't
do it. I just throw a debit card down and like, well, we're going to charge you $600 up front and then you'll get it back. Fine. I don't give a shit. Now it's like I went out to Vegas in like 2012 for SHOT Show. It was like when I finally broke down and got a credit card. It was like the shit that I went through and I ended up paying twice as much for the car and I had to show them the boarding pass that I was coming back. So they knew I was coming back to the airport. It was like so much bullshit. And I'm like, fine, I'll get a credit card and I'll get one for the wife too, so that we both can rent cars. And that's the only thing we have them for. That was very hard for me to do it because, you know, I had the time where I went out and spent all the money on credit cards and I spent all the money on, I had car payments and everything. And when I started the show, I had just paid off everything. Like I had just come out of that and I was like, I don't ever want to go back there. And I was a pretty big fan. I still am, I guess, of Dave Ramsey on his debt advice.
Yeah.
His investing advice, but his debt advice, you know, stay out of
debt. I have credit cards, but it's years since I carried a balance.
Yeah.
Month to month. Our cars are all paid for cash and everything. And our mortgage is going to be paid off very soon. So, I'm just really, really happy that, you know, I've been blessed in a lot of ways. And I think when you chase after the truth, and you're honest and you don't lie. You know, Owen Benjamin says something that I like a lot. He says, I may be wrong, but I don't lie. And that's my thing. I may be wrong sometimes, but I'm not lying to you. I'm honestly wrong. And I'll be the first person to tell you I was wrong on something. And people don't even like that. You know, people are very men have become very feminized nowadays, especially, you know, like fans of the show, you know, a lot of listeners of the show will be like, oh, you were wrong about this. I'm like, yeah, I was wrong. I apologize. I wasn't 100% wrong. Here's where I wasn't wrong about it. But then they're like, no, well, you were wrong about this. And I'm going to go listen to somebody who's never wrong.
Oh, geez, you're not going to find anybody then.
Are you? Okay.
Yeah. then you're also back to the whole, you know, why do you think that that's supposed to be that important to me? You know, I want to read this to you though.
Followers. Yeah. I'm not looking for followers, man. Yeah. I'm looking for people, you know, people who you can't rely upon followers because they'll go and find somebody else. So go ahead.
I just want to kind of read this to you. This is my disclaimers and policies. This was published in 2009. I've never changed it. And it's legally, so it's section 1, subset 3. The Survival Podcast is not and should not be viewed as a news source. While I often discuss current events and cite sources that are both conventional and unconventional media sources, once again, the views expressed are the opinions of one man. While I always strive for accuracy, I can and will be wrong at times, as any honest human will have to admit to. And I think that's what keeps something like you're doing or I'm doing running for years versus days or weeks or months, is that commitment to honesty. I have been wrong, and I will be wrong. I've even said I have the right to be wrong. That really pisses them off, by the way. You're welcome to steal that if you want to. Right. I have a right to be wrong because I can't wade out into the pool of risk without being willing to be wrong. Absolutely. I can't issue an opinion without being willing to be wrong. But I never get pissed off when somebody says you were wrong, especially when they show, okay, I was wrong. But when somebody infers that I'm being dishonest, that fucking pisses me off.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that enrages me when somebody accuses me of like deceiving or lying, or, you know, especially when I get accused of like carrying water for a politician. Like, if you showed up yesterday, I'll forgive you. If you've been here more than a minute, like, that's not a thing.
I had last year, but in 2024, I did a lot of episodes talking about the factions that I saw going behind Trump. Like, you know, I knew there was going to be the Zionist faction, that there was the tech bro faction, and, you know, Wall Street, obviously the financial faction. And I would tell people, you know, I would say, look, when it comes to it, I think that if the tech bro faction won out, you might be a little better off, because these are people who like competence. They try to get the most competent people in there. So, you know, Doge, because I was thinking about Doge and everything like that. And I'll have people now tell me, oh, you said that Trump was going to save us. And then I'll tell them, I'll be like, show me, find a clip of me saying that, find where I wrote that anywhere, and I will mea culpa all day long. But no, that's not what I said. That's what you wanted to hear.
Yeah.
Or you're just being a woman, you know, taking my words and trying to use them against me. Yeah. And like I said, you know, if there's one thing that pisses me off more than anything, it's just how feminized men are these days. They are just
a big part of our problems in our society, like the gay thing running rampant. I'll admit there are some people I just go, yeah, you probably were born gay. I get it. There are people you look at them from across the street and go, dude's gay. He can't help who he is what he is. But this, like, explosion in the whole LGBT, whatever the fuck, infinity letters and shit, like,
this is
from a feminization of society. My dad, when I was a kid, I used to think he was nuts, and now I realize he is nuts, but he's also smart. And he used to say, like, the goal of society is the domestication of the man. Like, that's what they're trying to do. And I realized that he wasn't talking like mankind. He meant men. Like, women are pretty much domesticated already. Like, it's to domesticate the human male. And if you think about what domesticate means, it's to remove all of the feral qualities, all of the wild innate qualities, and make it compliant. And how do you do that? You do that by giving it enough comfort and taking away all its needs. That's how we make a pig into a domestic pig. You take it from its parents when it's a baby, so it doesn't learn to be a pig, and you feed it everything it needs, and it'll live in a thing, and you can rub its belly like a dog. And that same pig, if it grows up in a swamp, will fucking kill you. It will fucking gut you and eat you, right? And so if we can domesticate an animal, then we can domesticate humans. And I think that's a big part of the problem. And then the diet, like, you feed them things that keep them alive, but do not make them strong, make them fat, right? They marbleize that meat, get more money for it, right? And you just look at, what are they feeding people? We have fucking fast food places in most high schools now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, maybe
when I was in high school, they had them.
Really?
You know, they had fast food type of shit. And my, you know, Oswald Spengler said that as soon as you reach civilization, you're on your downfall. Because what it takes to get to civilization is what makes men strong.
Hmm.
You know, you basically, you know, going out and taming the wilderness of this country, going across and dealing with Indians. You know, my wife's family were some of the first people who went to Texas with Steve Austin from Tennessee. And I mean, they got killed by Indians. Hmm. I mean, they were slaughtered by Indians. And I mean, these were real men and women who were strong and who had there was a certain aura about them. But as soon as you get civilized, I mean, what happens? You know, it's that whole weak men create hard times kind of thing. Yeah. It's in that vein. But once civilization hits, that's when you have to be on your guard, because civilization is going to make everything really easy. And when things get really easy, people get decadent, people get lazy. And that's when you see the downfalls of civilization. You see the downfalls of civilization because it became civilized. There's a certain level of civility, you know, certain levels of civility are just going to cause you to become fat and happy.
Yeah. And this country is soft. For all of our bravado, we're soft. And I could even see this 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when I was in grade school. You go back in the 80s, like, this is where a lot of things were happening in Eastern Europe. People were fleeing, like Poland, as part of the Solidarity movement and all. And I, like you, I grew up Catholic, and we had, because of that, we had kids coming into the church, the school, the Catholic school, that were from Poland and other parts of Eastern Europe. And those kids were freaking hard. They were tough because they had to be. Like, and there was instantly conflict, and it was because a thing that we would do to each other, just kind of messing around, and no one took it serious because it wasn't. That kid didn't get it and immediately would pop somebody in the fucking face. And I'm not saying they were right for that. I'm just saying they were tough like that. And as they figure out, like, dude, nobody's actually putting you down. This is just what we do here. Like, no one's going to, like, take your place away from you. But they had to learn that first. But my bigger point is how hardened they were. I mean, you're talking like eighth grade, right? Yeah. Most eighth graders here today, like, they're not going to step up like that. Or if they do, it's going to be completely ridiculous. That other segment of society, we won't go down that rabbit hole today.
I spent a good deal of time in Romania in the early 2000s. They were only about, 12, 13 years out of communism at that point.
Yeah.
Everybody knew how to do something. You know, it was like the average guy I would meet knew how to build a house. Like, from the ground up. Why? Because they had to know that. They had to be able to do that. They had skills that I don't have because I didn't grow up in an environment where I needed to build things, where I was struggling, where if I didn't do this, I died. That's what civilization is. Civilization is, you know, and I think, I honestly believe that strong religious, like, Spain was considered a Catholic country. It is a Catholic country still, but, you know, when it was a solidly Catholic country, and where these countries were under crowns, and there was a certain level of, there was a religious aspect to everyone. Like, to me, being Russian is being Orthodox. Mm. That's what most Russians, it's part of being Russian. Are.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that kind of identity too, I think, helps to stave off modernity. But modernity has attacked everyone. And, you know, there's, you know, in the West, I mean, there's just not, you know, you hear countries in Europe, like, we're going to have to go to war with Russia. I'm like, 20 years ago, living in Russia was really, really difficult. They still have that kind of attitude about them. They still have that instilled in them. You think you're going to go and you're going to beat Russians? Are you insane? They are going to waste you. Now, you can go in and bomb them and friggin' drop bombs on them and even drop nukes. Sure. But I mean, that also goes to show exactly how weak we've gotten, where all warfare is from the air.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. Because there are, I mean, I read an Army War College, me and a buddy of mine who's former infantry, we read an Army War College paper in like 2023 on my show. And it talked about how if the United States government was the United States military was Ukraine, and they fought as Ukraine is fighting against Russia, they would have been out of troops. in 2.5 months. That's, we're just set up for air, for these air wars. I mean, we're still fighting the Cold War too. I mean, everybody's, Maduro's a commie. We got to, okay, well, I mean, what's, is it 1985? What are we talking about here? So it's like, that's just another thing is, sure, there are a lot of guys who can go in there on the ground and get shit done, but there just aren't as many as there used to be.
No, no. I think there's a huge skill gap too. It's not just the toughness of the fighting. Like the skill gap is massive. Like I grew up at a time where I think it was going away. And because I was from a really small, poor area, I didn't know that. Like I learned all the things from my dad, from my uncles, from my grandparents and from my classmates. Right. Because like, even if your dad wasn't around or your uncle wasn't around, you need to do something, you hadn't done it yet, then somebody you went to school with probably had, because things like a car broke or whatever. You learn to change parts. You learn how to fix things because you can't afford to like have somebody do it for you. And I look at it now and go, as much as that was important to me, I didn't push enough of it into my son. I pushed more than most, but not enough. And it's because we get comfortable. I think it's what you said earlier about like once you get civilized, then you're lost. Like there's only one way to go. You peaked and there you go down. Have you ever considered this? I think the timeline that they put in the Matrix for the actual Matrix for the peak of society, the year was 1999. And God, I look at that now and go, wow, maybe that was a little more spot on than they planned. I don't know.
My big year for change was 2012. Okay. Not because of the Mayan calendar.
Yeah.
But because up until that point, up until 2012, I wasn't like really online.
Okay.
Like I was in some car forums and I wrote for some blogs and I did stuff, but I wasn't like scrolling Twitter and, you know, looking on Facebook and being on social media, like a lot. And it seems to me since 2012, people have become hyper online. And I think that's when you become hyper online, and I've seen this personally in my own life with people around me where they have no friends in real life. So they rely upon their like internet friends for companionship. And then if something goes wrong and they get cut off from it, it's like a real existential crisis for them.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have no friends now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing that was really important was I was like that for a while where it was like, you know, I was like, hey, a lot of my friends are online. We need to start meeting. You know, and that was part of the Old Glory Club. The Old Glory Club started online, started in a Telegram group. And then it was just like, boom, we got to start meeting face to face. And, you know, that's what part of doing it in different, having different chapters in different states is people live in different states in different areas of the state. I mean, we have 3 chapters in Tennessee, you know, West, Central and East. People get together all the time. I just got together with some guys on Saturday night. I'll be getting together with more guys in a couple weeks. And this is just what's really important is to be able to build social capital in real life. There is no social capital online.
I'm just thinking about that date and I'm wondering how close you are to being dead on. I definitely remember, and I'm going to say it probably began about 2012 and then just got worse, how I started to see politics creep into everything online. Things that didn't make any sense to me. Like I've always been in kind of the regenerative agriculture, permaculture space. And, you know, we've always had what we called the purple breathers in permaculture. They're like the super hippies and whatever. But it was never overtly political. And I remember like somewhere about that time is when we started seeing articles come out about like Joel Salatin farms racist. I don't know how somebody farms racist. And then all of a sudden it was everywhere. And it was not just that every other post on Facebook was a political post. It's that in these groups that were always kind of like useful. Like, you know, you're in a group about cars or you're in a group about reloading or you're in a group about growing, you know, your own food or something. And all of a sudden, either it was being torn apart by it or it was that group was so ideological. It was all from one side. But like but we're supposed to be talking about how to grow fruit. Right? How do we get into a discussion about social justice from how to graft a fruit tree? I think maybe you're onto it with that date. Like, it's that space.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. There's a really big gun trader forum in Atlanta, in Georgia, where I used to live in Georgia. I'm just right next door in Alabama now, called the Outdoor Trader. And, you know, it's a lot of people have heard of it. It's a gigantic, gigantic site. And I joined them like 2011 and like trade guns. You know, it's a state where you get private sales are legal and you're just, you know, all over the place. And right around 2012, right around the end of 2012, the political forum had to be made private. You had to request going into that political forum. Why? Because people had become insane. People mm-hmm. had become insane fighting. You didn't want people just joining the site to stumble into that, because there was a tab for new posts. So you hit new posts and it'll show you all the forums, you know, not only just the handgun, the rifle, the ammunition forum, but you got the political firearm talk and everything like that. And it would just be constantly into the political talk, and people would go in there, and I think they shut it down and made it private because people would go in there and be like, I'm getting the hell out of here. These people are just absolutely nuts. You know, it was Obama's president and it's the first place I saw people really Fed posting, you know, where you're just like, come on guys, you know, this is get offline. Let's do, you know, let's have a get together or something. This is why we trade guns face to face, get to know people. But yeah, man, 2012 was real. It was such a turning point for online. I mean, that's when the alt-right started happening. That's when poll started becoming really popular, 4chan. And yeah, it was a bad time.
Oh, don't get me started. We got to wrap up. I can't get started on the 4chan shit because there's so many things that people think are real. And it's just like a bunch of retards sitting around going, what can we get society to believe next? You know, right down to the okay symbol, right? Like
that's so funny. Yeah.
Do you understand? Like, it's one thing that you're manipulated by the trillionaires. I understand how that happens. You're getting manipulated by a bunch of kids that are sitting around trying to literally actually in their parents' basement going, what for lulz can we get them to believe next? And you just buy into it. And I think that our society has just been dumbed down. I think we've been made weaker in every way possible. And I don't know how much you get into this. I think it has a lot to do with the food supply.
I mean, it's
a huge part of it.
It's a lot. Since we, you know, since we moved out to Alabama, and now my wife grows our food and everything, you know, you can tell a difference. You can really, you know, you can tell. And we have local butchers and stuff like that. I don't have room to have, chickens, really. I have friends that have chicken houses, so I have access to eggs and stuff like that. But we have local places that sell like straight from the farm to table kind of stuff. So yeah, I mean, it's a big difference. It really does make a difference. And without the hormones and things like that, it's just, yeah, you know, I remember, yeah, I said that I used to spend a lot of time in Romania. I remember whenever I would come back to the States, spend some time here and then go back to Romania, like for the first week, I'd almost be staple gun to the toilet because the fresh food that I was eating there was like, it was like all the poison that I had eaten in the States was like coming cleaning out of my body, because everything that we were eating there was, was clean. And, you know, even like, you know, this butter and, you know, like tons of butter in the food and everything. Yeah, but it's all butter that they made. The food is fresh. Yeah. It was very easy to tell back then.
There's a lot of anecdotal evidence where people say, like, I went to Europe for 2 weeks, traveled all over the place, ate my fucking ass off, and came home, and I had lost 3 pounds.
Yep.
Which doesn't make any sense, but yet.
Yeah, El Salvador, too. El Salvador, we had the hotel we stayed at. Had menued breakfast every morning, and you know, we ate that every morning, ate a lot. We ate at restaurants there, and I think we lost weight when we were there. We did a lot of walking around too, but I don't think that had anything to do with it because we were eating a ton of food while we were there.
Yeah. Well, man, hey, this has been cool. You want to tell people how they can listen to you, learn more about things from your perspective and what have you?
Sure. The Pete Quinones Show, PeteQuinonesShow.com. Also, PeteSubstack.com. I put all my episodes there for subscribers. I put them up early and ad-free for people who give me as little as $2 a month on my website or Patreon or Substack. And, you know, you can find me there. And I'm on the Old Glory Club. We do three live streams a week. I'm on pretty much every other week, Thursday night at 8 o'clock on Pony Express Radio. But Monday night we have American Spirits, which is basically seeking to answer the question, what is an American? And then Chapter House is on Wednesday nights, where different chapters from around the country come on and talk about, you know, what they have going on, and just let people know what's happening.
Very cool. Well, I'll make sure there's links to all of that in the audio notes. Folks, if you're listening to us live, right down in the video notes, there's some links. One of those links will get over to the audio episode. If you're listening to us live right now, that'll take about 30 to 40 minutes from right now before that audio episode goes up. After that, you can get all the links for Peter's stuff and everything else that I talked about today over there. Peter, thanks for being with us today, man.
Thank you, Jack. Appreciate it.
All right, folks. Well, that went longer than planned, but that's great because it's a good discussion. Probably could have sat here and talked for another hour. But anyway, Peter's great, dude. Really is. Like I said, we worked together quite a bit back during the Unloose the Goose days and have been on each other's shows, and he's just always been a solid dude. And some of this evolved over time, which is something I really appreciate. Like, if you don't change your positions at all over time, that means you didn't learn anything new. Like, I've always said, you have to be wrong to learn something, and you have to figure out that you're wrong and admit that you're wrong to learn something. That's an exercise a lot of people just don't want to do in their life. And the older they get, the more that becomes the case. So it's nice to see another old fuck like me who continues to learn and evolve their positions across time. With that, if you like the show and you want to help support us, there's a lot of ways you can do that. One is become an MSB member. We get you lots of great discounts. I'm working on a few more right now. But we have enough discounts right now that there's no way that becoming a member actually costs you money other than you just choose not to use the discounts. So you can learn more about that at thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on the members tab to sign up there. And if you are military, law enforcement, first responder, all of those positions, I actually give you a service discount. Just email me before you join with TSPC, service discount in the subject line, and I'll get back to you with that discount code. Do that before, not after you join. It's not that I don't want to do it. It's just really, really, really a pain in the ass, especially since the discount applies to your recurring memberships. So that's a software limitation that I don't have the ability to fix. Next up, the other way you can do that is you can do your online shopping at tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. It's just basically a catalog of all the things that I use and I've purchased in my life there. But if you start your shopping there, even if you buy something I didn't review, you still help us out. My item of the day today is not an Amazon item. It's actually on Vivor, and it's these galvanized raised garden beds. And I brought this around yesterday, and the particular one I'm linking to sold out. But Vivor has a ton of these galvanized raised beds in different forms, configurations, shapes, etc. And I have a link in that review now as well where you can see like everything they make, from little round ones to great big rectangle ones. This is really a great way to go. If you want to expand your gardening and you're going to use raised beds, we did a show yesterday on nothing but raised beds, you know. This is kind of the way to go. Metal lasts longer than wood. It's lighter relative to its strength than wood. It ships to your house in panels in a flat box. You can put it together. It's a one beer job to put one of these together, fill it up and start growing. That's a hell of a lot easier than going to the box store, buying a bunch of lumber and put it all together. I ran the numbers for you in the article. You can't, it used to be you could. Today, with the price of lumber, you cannot build a raised bed out of lumber for less than you can do one of these. And that's with it shipped to your house. You don't have to leave. You don't have to go anywhere. And that's always nice. So please do your online shopping at tspaz.com. And also consider buying a copy of my book, Laws of Life by Jack Spirico. Get on over to Amazon. You can pick up a copy. And if you want to know more about the book, get over to jackslaws.com. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A show for the week.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.